years ago, my beautiful wife Amy and I were living in Portland, Oregon, as newlyweds. And we were full of joy, full of happiness, full of hope, and dirt broke. I remember a specific time in our marriage, about this time of year, after the summer had passed, and I was finishing up Bible college up in Portland, and my wife was working full time. And it was a time where we barely had enough money to pay our rent, to pay all the bills, and then also to pay for college and some of the other things that were in our lives. And so one of the things that took a back seat was food. We didn't have any money for food. I remember specifically looking at our budget and our finances, and after we had paid all our bills and after we had given in faith to God, I realized that there was nothing left. And we were like over a week away from our next payday. And so I looked at Amy and I said, "Well, what do we have to eat?" And she goes, "Not much." And I remember just thinking, why would God do this to me? Why would God put me in this spot? I'm trying to live for Him. I'm trying to put Him first in my life. He told me in the Bible, I've read it, gone to school to study it, because if you put me first, all the other things will be taken care of. And so I sat with my wife and we prayed and we asked God to just take care of us. And I'm not kidding. Moments later, we got a knock on the door. And at the door was somebody from our church that we were attending and serving with up there. And they had just tons of grocery bags of food. Just bag after bag was shoveled into our dining room. And inside there was, you know, boxes of Honey Nut Cheerios, and there was like stuffing, and there was like green beans, and there was all this great bounty of food. And my wife and I just kind of looked at each other in shock and in awe and just like wonder and realized that we had just experienced a miracle. Because as I've looked back on that time in my life and I've looked back on that moment, I realized something. Do you realize that the people at that church, we hadn't expressed that we were desperately in need of food, but the people of that church had decided to give of themselves to meet needs in the church. And the leadership of that church felt led, knowing that we were newlyweds, I was in school, they felt like maybe we could use some sort of encouragement, some sort of food that at that time. But God knew the big picture, didn't He? And what I thought about was this. I thought about the person who brought the Honey Nut Cheerios, or maybe like the can of green beans, right? And was like, what's this going to do? Well, seriously, what is my can of green beans going to accomplish for the kingdom of God? What is my box of Honey Nut Cheerios going to matter in the scheme of things? And I learned something that day that Jesus teaches here in this passage in John chapter 6, and that's this. Seemingly insignificant offerings placed into Jesus' hands turn into something that we can't imagine. Suddenly, they're incredible overflow. See, my wife and I didn't need as many bags as were brought in. We could have made it on maybe like 2 bags of groceries. But they brought in like 5, 6, 7 bags of groceries. A big old box of stuff. To the point where we were overflowing. We couldn't eat it all. And yet, the person who placed that box of Honey Nut Cheerios to the church and said, "Here, this is what I can give," probably thought, what's that going to matter? And yet, placed together and placed into Jesus' hands, it mattered big time in my wife and I's life. It sustained us for that period of time where we didn't have anything to eat. And I realized that day that God is a God of miracles. He's a God who can orchestrate and take care of things in our life, even when we don't think there's any human solution to our problem. Joining in John chapter 6 this morning, we're going to be looking at the first 15 verses in John chapter 6. And there's some things in your notes, and if you didn't get a set of notes, there's some on the back table back here. But on the top of your notes, I put a question, and I wanted to ask you this question because this is the focus this morning, and that is this. What are you doing with the blessings that God has deposited into your life? Throughout this morning, I want that question to resonate with you. What are you doing with the blessings that God has placed into your life? Are you hoarding them for yourself? Or are you turning around and blessing others? That's the real question that I want you to consider, because all of us as Americans have blessings in our lives. All of us who have 3 meals a day have blessings in our lives. And God wants to challenge each of us with this question. What are we doing with those blessings? There's some significance of some things in this story that I'm about to share with you. And so I want to go through these real quick. First, the story itself is recorded in all four of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and here in John. And that's significant because John is a man who pretty much wrote his own gospel, and he has his own focus, and he departed from the other three. The other three gospels are pretty similar in many accounts. And yet John kind of departs from all that because he has a case to prove. He wants to prove that Jesus is the Son of God. What's interesting here is that this miracle fits all four of the gospel writers' themes. This miracle shows all the things that these gospel writers are trying to portray in Jesus. And they all have different focuses. This, along with the resurrection, are the only two miraculous accounts that are recorded in all four of the gospels. So this is a very significant story that is shared here in John chapter 6. The setting we find is the far shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Sea of Galilee is kind of like a lake. It's a freshwater body of water. How many have been to Lake Tahoe? If you've been to family camp, you've been to Lake Tahoe, right? And Lake Tahoe is a good picture of what the Sea of Galilee looks like. The Sea of Galilee is about 13 miles long and 8 miles wide. Lake Tahoe is slightly bigger than that. And so if you've seen Lake Tahoe, you can get an image of what the Sea of Galilee over in Israel looks like and the type of terrain that is there. Although, on the far northeast corner of the lake where we believe Jesus went with his disciples here, it kind of looks like Mono Lake. Anybody been to Mono Lake in California? Now, if you've not been there, you're missing out. It's a treasure. Now, it's actually one of the worst places you could go. It's like deserted, it's ugly, it's a bird bath, really, is what it is. And it's one of the less fine places in California. But that's the setting of the Sea of Galilee on the northeast side, is it's really a desert terrain, remote, desolate. The season we hear in this story is nearing Passover. And why is that significant? That's significant. John wrote that in because, one, he wants to tell us the timetable of the events of what are transpiring. Jesus is now 2.5 years into his ministry. He only has 1 year left until he faces the cross. So we get a picture of where he is in his ministry. But also it's significant because the people of Israel, Passover conjures up all kinds of images for them. You remember, it's the moment that celebrates when Moses led the people out of Egypt, out of bondage, out of slavery, across the Red Sea, and they were free from their bondage to the Egyptians. And Moses had said, one day there's going to be a prophet like me who will come, and he will deliver you. He will come from God, and he will deliver you, and it will be the ultimate deliverance. The people had that expectation. And every Passover season, it's like they looked for that prophet, that Messiah, that would come and deliver them. Were they in bondage? Absolutely. The Roman government was tough on them. It was not fun living under Roman oppression. They weren't citizens of Rome. They were living as kind of like indentured servants of Rome. And they were constantly under the Roman oppression, and they were being beat down by the Romans, and so they were looking for an opportunity for, what is that deliverance that's been promised? And they looked for that. And that's the season that we find this story set in. The situation, masses of people were following Jesus, many out of selfish reasons. You're like, wow, they followed Jesus out of selfish reasons? I would never do that. Really? I thought Regina's got a special for reason sometimes. I found myself saying, Jesus can really take care of me in the future. And that's what the masses of people were thinking. Because he was healing them. He was healing their diseases. He was taking care of their needs. And so they were following him because they saw a man who could really provide for them and really take care of them. And these crowds were growing larger and larger and larger to the point where it says that Jesus had no place to get away. He had no time for himself. Can you imagine a 24-7 somebody knocking at your door saying, can you do this for me? Can you do that for me? That's Jesus' ministry at this point. And I love the solution that is offered in this story. Jesus uses a child's offering. How insignificant is that? What a child brings. Who a child is in the context of our adult world. He uses a child's offering to reveal that he is our sustenance, the bread of life. You remember last week we looked at the fact that Jesus is the Son of God and the Savior of man. He revealed that last week in chapter 5. And so the stage is set. And come with me to chapter 6. And it says this. Sometime after this. After what? Well, in chapter 5, he had been where? In Jerusalem, right? He had been in Jerusalem. We know at the beginning of chapter 5, it says he was there for a feast. Likely, it doesn't tell us. That's the one time. It doesn't tell us which feast he was there for. But we know there were three feasts a year that were celebrated in Jerusalem. One was Passover. We know it wasn't that one. Likely, it wasn't that one. It was the Feast of Weeks, which took place 50 days later. And then there was a set of feasts in the fall, known as Tabernacles, where the people would come and they'd celebrate when God tabernacled with them in the desert when they were delivered out of Egypt. He came and dwelt with them. He made his dwelling place among them. If you read the Old Testament, that's when they built the tabernacle, they dedicated it to God, and then God's Shekinah glory filled the temple. He came with them and dwelt with them. Well, they remembered these events. They celebrated them every year. And so likely, indeed, it was the Feast of Weeks in chapter 5, or it was the Feast of Tabernacles in the fall. Feast of Weeks happened about, like, June. Feast of Tabernacles happened, like, this time of year, September, October. But we know something, that by the time chapter 6 comes around, he's now, Passover is approaching again. That happens in the spring. We call it Easter today. And that was the time of year. So we know that there was like 6 months of time, at least, maybe 9, where John doesn't tell us anything about what was happening when Jesus was alive. So sometime after this records the fact that some time had taken place. And we know from the other Gospels some details as to what had taken place between chapter 5, when he healed that man, remember? Pick up your mat and walk. The man who was crippled for 38 years. He healed him. And he confronted the Pharisees there on the steps of the temple about who he was. And then now in chapter 6, he's back up at the Sea of Galilee. And we know some things took place. In Luke and in Mark, it tells us some of the events that took place during this time. Jesus spent significant time in Galilee teaching and healing during this period. Remember, he was gaining a great reputation at this point. 2.5 years into his ministry, people knew who he was. And people began to just hear that he was in the region, in the area, and they would flock to him. And they would stay there with him. They wouldn't go back home because they were just waiting. What is he going to do next? What can he give me next? We know that Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount. Remember in Matthew chapter 5, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the peacemakers. Remember that sermon that is taught in Matthew 5 through 7? We know that this is the time that he taught that. He was telling parables about the kingdom of heaven. John the Baptist had been beheaded. Remember, he had been arrested earlier in John. And now, we find out that during this period of time, John the Baptist is beheaded. He's killed. He's martyred. And you can imagine Jesus hearing about this, Jesus knowing about this, and feeling this. Remember, he's the Son of God, but he's also 100% man. And this was his cousin. This was a man who who had revealed that he was the one to come. So a ministry partner. And they had beheaded him. So imagine Jesus in his grief, wanting to retreat, wanting to get away, wanting to just be like, you know what? I've been ministering for like 6 months straight. I need a break. For my own sanity. And Jesus had sent his disciples to preach throughout the region. He had set them out to preach. And so in the other Gospels, it tells us that in Mark, it says that Jesus sent out the 12 to preach the gospel and work miracles. And when the apostles came back, they reported what they had done. Then, because so many people were coming and going, that they did not even have a chance to eat. They did not even have a chance to eat. And Jesus said, this is in Mark, come with me by yourself to a quiet place and get some rest. This is what Jesus was feeling. Come away with me. We need a time. We need a break. And it's okay to have some break in life, guys. It's okay. Right now, our pastor is in Hawaii. That's a nice break, right? He's in Hawaii with his wife, enjoying a break. Now, I work closely with Kurt, and I know his schedule, and I know how much work he does and how involved he is in many of your lives. And so I know that he does need a break. And so it's good. It's a good thing for us to take a break so we can get refreshed and renewed and re-energized so that we can get back into what God has for our lives. And that's where Kurt is right now, and that's where Jesus was wanting to go. And so it says in John chapter 6 again, Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias. It had like four names, and they all had significance. I don't have time to get into that right now. And a great crowd of people followed him. So they followed him on foot. They kind of like walk around the lake. It's a big lake. They were very committed to being with Jesus. Jesus had hopped in a boat, and he had sailed across. He'd gotten across the sea, landed on another shore, and it says a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples, which he let the Jewish Passover feast was near. Verse 5, when Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, in Mark it says, many who saw them leaving recognized them, and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Imagine that. They're running along the sea. Like, we're going to catch up. He's right over there. Come. In Matthew, it says that he saw them and had compassion on them. And he healed their sick. Because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them again many things. In verse 5 of John chapter 6, it says this, Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him. Remember, this is kind of like break time. Jesus could have said, go away. Don't have time for you. Give me like 3 days and I'll be back with you guys. But he didn't. His heart is just so full of love and compassion towards the people. It overflowed. And he cared for them. But the disciples face a real and difficult challenge. And what is that challenge? The challenge is the fact that a hungry mass of desperate people were closing in on them, looking to them to solve all of their problems, including their hunger pain. I want you to place yourself for a second following Jesus, and you're with Jesus, and you see a crowd of 5,000 men plus women and children heading your way, and they've been following you for like days now, and they've all run out of food. And they're desperate and they're hungry, but they won't go away. What do you do? How do you take care of them? Well, that was their situation, these disciples. And so many solutions are common. In Matthew chapter 14, it tells us that one solution is common, or thought about, or offered up to Jesus. Listen to what it says in Matthew 14, verse 15. It says this, as evening approached, the disciples came to Jesus and said, this is a remote place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food. I love the disciples. Avoid the problem. It's not our problem. Send them away, Jesus. Is it okay if we just send them away? Is that all right? Is it okay to just dodge our responsibility? And Jesus, you know, says, they do not need to go alone. You give them something to eat. You give them something to eat. He says, everything you need, you have. You got it. Figure it out. Boy, I love Jesus. He loves to put it right back on our plate. And he said to Philip, verse 5, where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Think about this. Jesus looks at Philip. Why Philip? Well, I don't know, Vincent, I do know this. Philip was from the town of Bethsaida, which the Bible tells us is one of the closest villages to where they were. But so Jesus tells us, hey, Philip, you're from around here. What do you think? What should we do? How can we feed these people? And so Philip answers him, thinks about it for a little bit, and goes, 8 months' wages, literally 200 denarii in the Greek, would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. I want you to think about this, because what Philip realizes is there's like 10,000 people there, at least. There's 5,000 men we know from the Bible, and another passage says besides women and children were there. And so we know that there was masses of people, and so Philip's calculating in his head. Must have been a good mathematician. He's sitting there going, okay, 5,000, you know, and he's figuring this all out, and he goes, man, that's going to be like 8 months worth of wages. And how much is 8 months worth of wages today? Maybe $30,000? Can you imagine a meal that costs $30,000? That's what it costs to feed, like, Arco Arena. You know, you go to Arco Arena and everybody in there goes, free meal! 30 grand. Who wants to pick up that tab? What's interesting here is some scholars say, well, the disciples didn't have that kind of money. Remember, they were dependent on people that just supported Jesus' ministry. And yet there seems to be kind of a thing where they did have some money. Remember, they had a treasurer. Right? They had a treasurer. His name was Judas Iscariot, who was later betrayed Jesus. He was the money handler. And a swindler. Kind of like Tyler last week. And you guys will recall the fact that they had some resources at their disposal, but this might have been like a whole chunk of change that they had. And they're thinking, man, we've got to set up a kingdom here. This is the Messiah we're following. We've got to save our wages. Do you really expect us to go buy that amount of food, $30,000 worth of food, to feed all these people? Yeah, that would only give them like maybe a bite to eat. And Mark, it says that are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? And then he says this, how many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. Go and see. Go and see. You know, the first thing that was offered is this whole thing, avoid responsibility, right? Avoid my thing. Then Philip, he asks alone. But here's the problem with asking alone, when a problem presents itself. We are always limited by our human possibilities. If I were to turn to my wife and go, well, can you pawn your wedding ring? Right? How much can you get for that? Gotta eat. And I begin to like formulate in my mind all these solutions that exclude God. How many times have you just with that? We face a problem in life, and the first thing we do is we start to solve it in our own mind using human possibilities. And that's Philip. That's exactly what Philip was doing. And Jesus said, no, I'm not gonna go out now. Why don't you go out in the crowd and see what you can find? And so the Bible tells us that Andrew is the first one back from the crowd. He's fast. That's what Andrew. Simon Peter's brother. And in verse 8 it says this. Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far will they go amongst the men? Now, my mind thought about how did this really take place? How did this really happen? And this is what I thought about. I thought about like the disciples going in the crowd and going, anybody got any food? Right? And I can imagine like some people, and I don't know, I'm just speculating, some people might have been like, yeah, I don't know. And there might have been others that were like, I got a whole sandwich, but that's all mine. Right? Or there could have been nothing in the crowd. These people might have been just straight out of food. But there is this boy. And I like to think about the fact that this boy probably was like, I got something. I got this whole like basket, 5 loaves of bread. This is a good lunch for this boy. His mom packed his lunch well. All you moms in the crowd, like 5 loaves of bread and 2 fishes. Great meal for a boy. Not so great a meal for 10,000 people. And so Andrew goes, dude, I have this kid. He wants to get his meal. He's willing. He's willing, but how far is that going to go? And he comes back to Jesus. And again, the idea that we ask around, but we're limited by human possibilities. We're limited by a human perspective. And so whenever we take the problems that God allows into our lives and we exclude God from the equation, we're going to end up in frustration. We're going to end up in a situation like the disciples where they don't see any answer to the problem. And the crazy thing is the answer is right in front of them, isn't it? The answer is absolutely right in front of them. Are they still blind? Yeah, they are. Is the answer right in front of us? Yeah. Remember Jesus said, you search the scriptures to find me? These are the scriptures that tell about me, that define me, that describe who I am. And here we are, we're in the church, we have the scriptures, and yet we face problems in life. What do? We don't run to God very often, do we? We try and solve it ourselves. We try and use our own human reasoning, our human perspective. And guess what? We end up in frustration. That's where they're at. And so Jesus says, go and see, and they tell him that there's this boy. And it's like God to place the meal that's there available in the hands of the child, right? Because who is it that's willing to believe so easily? What did Jesus say? Unless you have faith like a child, you never enter my kingdom. Here's this little boy going, he's not thinking of himself, is he? He could have thought like, well, if I give this, what am I going to have left? Right? But a little boy is excited. Jesus is interested in my meal. I'm going to give him all of it. That's faith, guys. That's faith when you're willing to surrender all of what you have and place it in the hands of Jesus. Knowing that your insignificant offering, what seems like an insignificant offering in Jesus' hands, can turn into an incredible overflow. And so, the solution is provided. Jesus says this, bring them here to me. So his disciple goes back out to the crowd. I imagine that he probably even brought the boy up. The boy's probably like, I'm not sure, I don't know if I trust you, but I trust Jesus. He's like, okay, come on up. He's got his like 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He comes up. He's so excited because now he has the attention of Jesus, the one that all the crowds hope to have the attention of. And he's like, and so he hands over the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and Jesus says, have the people sit down. And Luke tells us they sat down in groups of about 50 or 100 each. And there was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, and about 5,000 of them. And Matthew tells us that besides women and children. And Jesus took the loaves in John chapter 6, verse 11. And Matthew says he looked up to heaven, recognizing who it is that provides, God the Father, and he gave thanks and distributed to those who received as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. The other gospel said that the disciples were the ones who actually went out in the crowd. It's like Jesus handed it to the disciples. The disciples went out, gave it to the group of 50. Here, pass this around. Went back to Jesus, got more. Went out. And that happened over and over again until all the groups of 50 or 100 that were out there, he had their fill with him. He he did the same at the fish, verse 12. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted. Isn't that interesting? Jesus didn't want to waste even an ounce of what that child had offered to him in faith. When you give to God, God doesn't want that wasted. God cares about making sure that everything is used for his kingdom. Let nothing be wasted. So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets. Matthew says four with the pieces of the five barley loaves. And Mark says, and the fish that were left over by those who had eaten. My question to you is, where do these baskets come from? And what are they? Why 12? And here's what's interesting. In studying this, the baskets, it's not like people are just carrying baskets around. Have you ever thought about that? Like, well, who was just like, oh, I've got to take this big basket with me? Right? That wasn't happening. Likely this word was used as the thing that was carrying people who were crippled. See, in those days, they didn't have, like, stretchers. They had baskets, and they would carry the lame and the crippled and the people that couldn't walk. See, these were, like, man-sized baskets. That's the word that's used here. They give you a new perspective on how much leftovers there was. Here's the other thing that's interesting. Why are they now not used for carrying the crippled? Because Jesus had healed them. So now these baskets are extras. They're like something that doesn't need to be used anymore. But people are probably like, I got a basket. Here you go. And the disciples are like, cool, we got some baskets now to get all the leftovers. And it ends up filling 12 of these baskets. Jesus is trying to make a point. The number 12 is very significant in Israel. How many tribes were there? There were 12 tribes in Israel. The number 12 is very significant to the people. There were, how many disciples were there? How many gates in the temple were there? There were 12 gates. How many elders in heaven are seen in Revelation? 12. And the number 12 goes on and on in the Bible, but the point is, it's like, the number 12 represents all of Israel, all of God's people. And what Jesus is saying, I am sufficient for everyone. I am the all-sufficient God. That is the point that is being made here in this story. And so a solution is provided. Try giving it all over to Jesus. That's the point of the story. And trust in the prophet, Jesus Messiah. We sang about it earlier. The prophet that was to come, Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15. The people were looking forward to the prophet Moses said one day would come. And in verse 14, it says this, after the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, really, this is the prophet who is to come into the world. In verse 15, Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. The people were in a frenzy at this point. And I think this was a temptation for Jesus. Would he become the king without the cross? The people wanted him. The people were like, yeah, force him. Become our king, our deliverer, our great prophet to come. We recognize it's you. Jesus said, yeah, it's me. But that's not the way I'm going to deliver you. And it's true. Jesus was committed to his journey, and his journey was going to lead him to the cross. I'm going to close with this. What would you bring to Jesus? Would you bring in your excuses? But Jesus, I don't have anything to give. Jesus, I don't recognize any blessings in my life. How can I give? Is that what we bring to Jesus? Or do we bring him our everything? That's what the little boy did. He brought him everything. Don't lose sight of that little boy. Probably had hunger pains of his own, and yet he took the whole basket that was rightfully his, and he handed it over to Jesus. And said, Jesus, in your hand, this can really become something awesome. I believe. That's what God wants from us. In America, success is defined by the next purchase. In other places around the world, success is defined by a simple meal. And a nice conversation with a family or friends. The accumulation of stuff is added to our net worth that deems us worthy in relationship to others. Therefore, we passionately pursue the next purchase in an attempt to raise our own perceived value. Many of my daily preoccupations suggest that I belong more to this world than to God. Our addictions make us cling to what the world proclaims as the key to self-fulfillment, accumulation of wealth and power, attainment of status and admiration, lavish consumption of food and drink, and sexual gratification with no boundaries. These addictions create expectations that cannot but fail to satisfy our deepest needs. My prayer, as we close this morning, is this: that we never read the story in John chapter 6 again without realizing that we're the boy in the story. In the context of a crowd of tens of thousands with nothing, we have it all. That's our situation as Americans. That's our situation in this world in Jesus Christ. And my challenge, my closing challenge, and may this sink deep in your heart, is this: what are you going to do with the blessings that God has blessed you with? Will you bring it to Jesus, or will you bring Him excuses? Will you bring Him everything, or will you bring Him some excuse as to why you cannot? Let's pray. I'm going to ask the worship team to come forward, and as we respond this morning, Father, we recognize this morning that I know I've been guilty of reading this story that is recorded in John and going, great, you're an amazing God that can do amazing things. And great, this is really cool that you provided for those people way back then. But I've read it many times that I've missed the point that you're trying to speak into my heart. The point that you're trying to speak to us today, and that is that we are that boy. We are that boy. We have been given a tremendous blessing and gift from you, God. We are rich in this world. And you're asking, are we willing to lay it down at your feet? Are we willing to give back to you, Jesus? Because what is it? Seemingly an insignificant offering in your hands, Jesus, becomes suddenly an incredible overflow. God, help us to believe that. Help us to believe that.